This is the Queensland Country Hour with Amy Phillips on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Snappy temperatures across much of southern Queensland mark the end to green pastures. But it did nothing to dent the enthusiasm of restockers at the Toowoomba cattle sale, with competition fierce on even feeder weight classes. But is this sustainable with the likes of protein levels now heading south with those temperatures?
Might bring the markets back a little bit. You know, it seems to supply and demand, and the sheep and cattle market, goat market, they're all red hot at the moment. So it'll be interesting to see.
Time will tell. And 10 pastoral houses have thrown their support behind the revitalisation of the Longreach Pastoral College, with labour shortages helping spur on a need for agricultural training once again. But first up today, horticulture growers have been celebrating over the weekend after an extension to a, what some say, is hastily thought of state government promise pitting irrigators against each other. On the eve of the Queensland election last year, the Labor Party announced some croppers, like banana growers, will have access to a 50% reduction to irrigation costs. But the likes of macadamias, well, they were left high and dry. Now, after what could be said arduous negotiations, according to the QFF, nuts, turf, flowers and nursery growers will now have access to a 50% price reduction election commitment for horticulture, irrigation, water users. QFF policy advisor Sharon McIntosh has been doing the lion's share of the negotiations and says some irrigators will still only to be able to receive a 15% discount. She explains who's in which camp.
After a long debate with government, who changed the goalposts between horticulture and fruit and vegetables, we now have not only fruit and vegetables, but we do have nuts, turf, flowers and nursery growers will all have access to a 50% reduction in the irrigation prices, and cotton and cane will have 15%.
Wow, it doesn't sound like that was an easy process, despite the fact that the government made the promise, but it sounded like it had hairs on it.
Yes, I don't think it was very well thought out, given the fact that there's still an equity in the pricing, and I don't think it's fair that farmers should be given a discount depending on what crop they grow.
How can the likes of horticulture irrigators access now this rebate?
Horticulture users will have to access the rebate through QRider. Unfortunately, we are still in negotiations and consultation with the government on how this will be administered. We are quite concerned on how this will be administered and what extra farmers will have to do to get this 35%. It won't be easy, which is what the government did state in their media release, that taking advantage of big cuts to the price of irrigation water will be made easy. None of this will be made easy. None of this process has been easy from the start.
So does 50% though mean a 50% rebate on your irrigation prices? Because I understand there is a price freeze also under question by the Queensland government.
Yes, they actually are currently on a price freeze from the 2019 and 2020 prices, which will finish on the 30th of June. However, we will still get a price jump. For many irrigators, that will mean a 15% or more price jump. So therefore, those will be achieving the 15% won't get that discount. And for those that are getting a 50% discount, it will definitely not mean 50% for most. It may mean anything from 5% right up to 42%, for example. So I just want to make that clear that 15% and 50 is definitely a step forward in achieving equitable and sustainable pricing. However, it does not mean the full 50 or 15%.
So some cotton and cane growers especially could be back to square one.
Correct.
Even after going through what could be an arduous process with QRider to access this funding.
Yes, yes. For everyone, though, they will automatically get a 15% reduction off their bill. So that's something that farmers won't have to do, which we're quite happy about. However, we did want the 50%, and we have continuously pushed the 50%. So we would avoid any administrative burden on farmers. And secondly, to make it fair for all and actually give everyone a discount. At 50% on the calculations that QFF have undertaken, a 50% discount meant everyone would have received a discount at least.
When does this all kick in?
On the 1st of July this year.
When can people start talking to QRider about accessing that?
Unfortunately, the government have not got anything firm in place as to how this process will be undertaken yet.
Right. More work to be done.
Correct. We still have a fair way to go, and it is almost the end of May, so we're quite eager to see how this is going to be played out by the 1st of July for farmers.
That's Sharon McIntosh. She is the Water Policy Advisor with the QFF, Nuts, Turf, Flowers and Nursery Growers, now joining everyone else in horticulture to access a 50% price reduction election commitment for irrigation water users, the likes of cane and cotton, though. You'll only have access to 15% if, in fact, all other rebates don't cancel that out. All other increases, might I say, cancel that out. You will have to go via QRider to access this. More detail is to come. We'll keep you updated here on the Queensland Country Hour.
The Queensland Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
For years, Australia's farmers have pegged their future prosperity on the growing Chinese market. But as you know too well, that all came crashing down this time last year, with some industries such as barley, lobster and beef targeted by a barrage of trade sanctions. Today, though, we want to bring you stories of some remarkable turnarounds and some important lessons. Let's join rural reporters around the country to explore what happened to those hardest hit, starting in Tasmania with Fiona Breen.
First it was COVID and then trade barriers with China that saw the collapse of demand for Australia's exports of rock lobster. China bought about 90% of the national rock lobster haul. The fishing fleets in WA, South Australia, Victoria and Tasmania came to a standstill. At its peak 2 years ago, Tasmanian fishers were getting up to $130 a kilo. Recently, it plummeted to as low as $20 a kilo. At Margate Wharf, fisher Kent Way is selling to locals. It's 12 months since we've had some of this disruption to the market with China. What's changed 1 year on?
We have lost most of our markets to overseas, mainly China. For us, personally, what's changed? We operate two vessels. I have one tied up next to me here that hasn't operated for nearly 3 months. I've lost my skipper and crew. They've had to go to, they're working on a fish farm, so they were lucky to get that job. I suggested they head in that direction because I couldn't guarantee them an income. Their pays had probably dropped between 30 and 50%. We have continued fishing at a much reduced operating costs as well. So we've looked at some of our operating costs and tried to cut some corners, but we haven't made a profit in 6 months. Our last trip was the first time we've made a profit in 6 months, Fiona.
So prices at the moment, are they still right down? Because you did reach low levels of something like $25 a kilo beach price at one point.
Yes, Fiona, we the price has come up since January, February. The prices were really low, down around $20 a kilo, $20-$25, depending on the animal. We have been receiving somewhere between $45 and up to $70 in the last few weeks, but it's only a temporary measure. A lot of the other states aren't working at the moment, and we're the only ones supplying the local market. It's a short-term thing. It might last for the next couple of months, and after that, I can see in November, December, January, it's going to be a lot of lobsters come in. They're all going to be heading towards the local market, and the price will plummet again, and more boats will have to tie up.
Thank you, Kent Way, lobster fisher down here in Margate in southern Tasmania. So hope there that talks with China will resume and that market opens sooner rather than later. Time now to talk about wine, and we're joined by Lucas Forbes in South Australia. G'day, Lucas.
G'day, Fiona. The Australian wine industry's troubles started in November when the Chinese government put tariffs on Australian wine, effectively ending a trade worth more than $1 billion to the Australian industry. The Chinese government alleged that the Australian industry had been dumping cheap wine into the Chinese market, effectively underselling their own producers. That's something the industry has continually denied to this day. However, that's left the Australian industry with a massive hole to fill, a massive hole roughly in the shape of 130 million litres of wine that it needs to find a home for. I'm here at Killiconoon Wines, one of the largest wineries in the Clare Valley. To find out more, I'm joined by Killiconoon General Manager Travis Fuller. Mr. Fuller, how would you describe the impacts of the Chinese government's tariffs on Australian wine?
Well, the impact's upwards of $10 million per annum, which doesn't seem like a lot, but that's a lot in a local community such as Clare, and all of that money essentially comes back here or starts here.
What are you hearing about the impact on the wine industry?
Well, it's significant. I mean, there are upwards of 1,000 businesses and wineries in Australia that were purely geared to the China market, and that was their sole output for the wine that they produced. There are others that have a more diverse footprint, such as ourselves and plenty of others, where China was a piece of the business. It was a growing portion. It's not one that we wanted to throw away because we've invested heavily to be there. However, you know, the reality is that all of the players who had distribution in China now have to look for other outlets.
How would you describe the health of the wine industry in the current context?
Look, I think we're thriving at the moment. There's a lot to be done, don't get me wrong. But if we put in COVID-19, which we haven't really covered as well, there's been closing of some markets, but this whole idea of direct-to-consumer, of cellar doors in the region, of people buying off online stores has grown enormously. That has not only increased the volume, but also the value of sales in the domestic market in the last 12 months significantly. So, you know, it's all about innovation in the wine industry, and we've been slow at it in some ways, but, you know, we're starting to get some momentum.
Mr. Fuller, thank you for taking us through what's going on in the wine market. But now it's time to find out what's been happening in the barley market with Joe Prendergast.
300 kilometres north of Perth, Jeff Cosgrove is ploughing a paddock ready for seeding. He dropped barley out of his grain growing program last year. That was when China placed an 80% import tariff on Australian barley, effectively shutting down what was a $1.5 billion trade. But this season, he's back to normal plantings. He'll put in about 800 hectares, and that's a decision based on agronomy and also the swift recovery of the barley price to about $280 a tonne.
It dropped down to probably $220 straight away when the first was talked that the tariff would go on. But it did come back by harvest, probably got back up to that sort of 280 range, I suppose, which is pretty manageable from our perspective.
What would you say is the most important thing you've learnt from these trade disputes with China that we've seen over the past 12, 24 months?
Probably don't panic too much, too quickly. A lot of it's out of our control. As growers, basically, yield's still king. Just grow as much of anything that you're growing, as much as you can. You know, the entire world market's still consuming grain. Obviously, a lot of ours was going to China and it was nice and easy, but there's still livestock production in every other country in the world that are feed grains. And it was just a matter of finding a home for the barley.
What would you do if you were the trade minister? How would you try and sort out this situation with China, this lack of dialogue and this ongoing tension?
Well, if I was the trade minister, I'd probably ring all the other ministers, the foreign minister, the prime minister and all the rest, and tell them to stop stirring them up and start with, you're making my job pretty hard. But yeah, speak to the customer, see what, you know, try and get to the bottom of what the issue is. China obviously works in a different way to how we work here. If you can't come to a reasonable conclusion or solution, you know, it might be as well to walk away, not burn any more bridges, just get out of there and find somewhere better.
After losing its biggest customer, the barley industry has steadied. Beef and lamb have also been impacted by trade tensions. John Daly has more from Queensland.
The beef industry was pulled into the fray last year when China suspended several export licences for facilities in New South Wales and Queensland for labelling and chemical residue issues. Export value and volumes to China have declined 28% and 35% last year, But the drought and increasing supply from South America also played a role in that. Anthony Winter is a Wagyu cattle producer in southern Queensland, and he lost market access when the abattoir his processor used was slapped with an export ban. But he has since managed to find ways around trade barriers.
I suppose we're in unknown territory. Surprisingly, there hasn't been too much change. I mean, yes, we were concerned about it. We're lucky enough that we have a brand. We have established relationships with our customers and with our suppliers. And I guess, yeah, we've built on the efficiencies that we sort of brought in due to drought. It's really been onward and upward. We haven't had any major setbacks that we were worried we were going to have.
So essentially you have found another abattoir and you have kept your access to that key Chinese market?
Yeah, that's true. So when the ban went on Casino, which is where our cattle were going, our customer, they moved to another abattoir where they were able to get enough kill space, and yeah, just all we do, we just truck our animals to a different place now. Yeah.
So if you were trade minister, if you had some kind of control over this trade relationship with China, what would you do?
I guess just from my point of view, it's certainly shown, we've certainly seen how important it is not just to rely on one customer. In saying that, China is obviously a huge part of, you know, part of our business in Australia, whether it's for Wagyu product, barley. So yeah, we've got to continue to deal with China. They're such a huge customer. But we also have got to remember not to have all the eggs in one basket.
The Federal Department of Agriculture says its technical submissions and efforts to overturn the bans have made little progress. In the meantime, rising domestic demand and other countries like Japan and South Korea are softening the blow for displaced exports. Now I'll hand it over to Kath Sullivan, who's talking to the decision makers in Canberra.
Thanks very much, John. Things really started to spice up last year when the Chinese ambassador to Australia suggested that the Chinese public could boycott Australian produce if the government continued its push for an independent inquiry into the origins of COVID-19. In December, Australia got a new trade minister in Dan Tehan. One of his first jobs was to write to his Chinese counterpart seeking to settle the dispute. He says he's still waiting on a reply.
Keep waiting. I said when I became trade minister that I would take a very proactive stance, that I would take a very principled stance, but also a very patient stance where necessary.
Will you now refer China to the WTO over the wine tariffs?
Well, look, that's something that we've got under active consideration. I've been in discussions with the industry about what is the next course of action. And as I've said, one of the things that I was very committed to when I became Trade Minister was taking a very principled approach. So where there has been injury to our industry, then I think we should use all the mechanisms that we have available to us.
So when might you make a call on that?
I would assume that we'll be in a position to decide what we're going to do next in the coming weeks.
Okay, it's not just wine grapes that are in hot water with China. I understand there have been significant delays to Australian table grapes. What's your understanding of that situation?
We're trying to work out what is the cause of the hold-up. About 80% of our table grape exports seem to have got in seamlessly. It seems to be the last 20% where there are some issues. So
that's 20% of grapes spoiling?
Well, potentially, yes. Some of them have been held up at the border. So we're trying to just get an assessment of what's going on. And one of the things where the industry can help us is make sure they keep us informed from what they're hearing from their Chinese customers on the ground.
Would you now classify table grapes the same way as perhaps cotton and lobster?
Well, we're working through the issue and trying to get a real understanding, and we don't want to jump to any conclusions. At first, it seemed like it was just one particular port where there seemed to be a problem. So we're trying to work through all this, and we'll keep assessing it. We'll keep talking to the industry. We understand how important the market is to them, and we want to get to the bottom of it. And that's why our officials are also working through this issue with with Chinese officials.
Dan Tehan, he's the Federal Trade Minister, finishing that report looking at how the industries hit hardest by Chinese trade tensions are faring exactly 1 year on.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
as they say, there's a first time for everything, as was the case at the State Sheep Show being held at Longreach on Friday. Congratulations to Mount Ascot Pat winning Supreme Exhibit and Queensland Ram of the Year, now 2 years in a row. Well-known stud owner Nigel Brumpton says he's probably the biggest ram he's ever bred.
You're always moving forward, but just at the moment...
That's not what I'm after. Give me a second. Here he is.
The physical attributes of that ram, look, he's massive, heavy bone. Look, he's 165 kilos, so that's as big as... Probably would be the biggest ram that's ever been produced in Queensland. Big, deep ram, and, yeah, great outlook. And, yeah, he's a very handsome creature, I suppose, and he's just, got a good wool on him. And, you know, that's where the industry's going. He's a real dual-purpose type of merino. So, that ram will sort of stand up against any meat sheep or anything with the amount of meat and the amount of wool he's got on.
Why his size?
Oh, he just, the family we bred him from, he's a sort of fairly growthy family, the early maturing and infertility, and he's just probably one of the best sides we've ever bred out of them, Amy.
So is the industry desiring a bigger merino?
Yes and no. Certainly in Queensland, our sheep can get a lot bigger, but we're mainly, it's our feed that doesn't let our sheep grow much bigger, but certainly in southern states where they get a lot better protein source all year round, their sheep are probably big enough, because we do have to manhandle merinos or any sheep. And look, the shearers, you've got to think of the shearers, and we can get our sheep too big. Like, certainly that ram's too big for a shearer handle on his own. But our merino ewes in Queensland can certainly get more size in them. But in the southern states where the feed's a lot better, they'd probably get into the size where we need to sort of start thinking about that's big enough.
How interesting. Do you often re-enter the same ram year after year?
No, we don't usually, Amy, but this ram came around. Look, we had him in an AI centre, getting semen out of him for a few months, and he was shorn there, and we inspected him for show again, and then it was actually the good thing of why he came around again. So what we're really interested to see how he came around again so much, because we worked him so much, we got so much semen out of him, and also paddock joined him, so he was... It was our joint in the paddock up till Christmas time, so he didn't come in the shed till late. So he's out working, and he's got a lot of progeny on the ground now. So he's worked pretty hard for the year, and we just put him in the shed as a safe haven for him, keep away from dingoes and everything else. And we just left him there, and he just kept on getting better and better in there. So we thought, oh, we've got him there now, we might as well just take him to the show. So it's, that's the way he ended up over the second year.
His reward for all his hard work, by the sounds of things.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, so we AI'd him here only a few weeks ago. We collected semen out of him, and he's got lambs on the ground now, which will be at next year's show circuit. So he's got a progeny around, and they're showing a lot of promise, which is the exciting thing of it.
And where does your AI program get sold to? How far away are those clients?
Oh, as far as semen goes, that ram we sent some semen to West Australia and everything. So they sort of goes around a bit, but we mainly use them in our own operations here. We mainly, in our AI program a few weeks ago, we sort of gave him a lot of ewes, and that's a good thing about collecting semen. You can put one ram over as many ewes as you want when you collect semen from them, rather than, paddock joining, they're probably limited to 100 ewes, but you can put them over thousands if you want to by collecting semen.
Well, congratulations to Mount Ascot. Pat, I just have another question for you, Nigel Brumpton. Was there any frost there this morning?
Yes, certainly was. Very, very chilly here this morning. Yeah, they took minus one, so I didn't look at the thermometer, but they certainly took minus one, and it's very cold, the cold wind outside today and yesterday.
Yeah, isn't there? Certainly here in southern Queensland too. What's that going to mean for your grazing operation? It obviously will mean that your pastures will dry off. Will that then steady up the market, do you believe? Sheep prices are red hot. Where to from here?
Oh, look, we're lucky. This is probably one of the best seasons we've had for years, Amy, so we're very fortunate, but certainly the frost does take protein out of the feed, but that's reality. Happens every year. Unless we've got feed for it to take protein out of this year, other years we haven't. So, and it certainly will. It'll affect this. I think it'll probably might bring the markets back a little bit. It seems to supply and demand, and the sheep and cattle market, goat market, they're all red hot at the moment. So it'll be interesting to see.
Time will tell. Nigel Brumpton, negative one at his place at Mount Ascot near Mitchell this morning. But alongside those results, the Australian Association of Stud Merino Breeders swore in a new president. Max Wilson from Dirranbandi's Wilgunya Merino Stud has taken the top job. He gave Madeline McCosker the pitch as to why now is the time to be in Merinos.
You're always moving forward, but just at the moment we just need to get everybody back to the table. We need to move forward on promotion. We need to get all about advocacy. We need to promote ourselves. We need to just draw everybody together, take it forward. It's just about everybody seeing sheep as a good option to be on commercial enterprise. We've got the issues of dogs in Queensland and South Australia and Western Australia. You've got all sorts of reasons why not to be in them. With Merino sheep, it always helps if you've got a mad passion for them because they are a bit extra work. But I think the rewards are there at the moment. We've got we're lucky to have a fairly strong wool market. Even though we've been knocked around considerably by COVID, it's climbed back, you know, 500 cents since August last year, sort of thing, or since February last year, she took a dive. It's just a good enterprise to be in because you get two hits at the sword. At the moment, you've got the meat side of the animal that's never been better, and you've got the wool side. So you get two cracks at the cherry.
What do you see as some of the biggest issues that the industry is facing at the moment and moving into the future?
Oh, well, you've always got opposition with other industries, your red meat industries. We've got competition from goats, which is great to see, but it's actually nice to see that ferals have become a productive product in our environment. And without getting too political, we've had a lot of our timber regulations taken away from us, so people see goats as an opportunity to get their country back in control.
You can see why Max Wilson from Dirranbandi has been made the new Australian Association of Stud Merino Breeders. Congratulations, Max. Coming up on the Country Hour, you're going to meet a horse masseuse. Yep, the ultimate treat for your equine friend. But now, Anthea Moody's in the studio with me, both in our warm clothes. What else is making news?
The global construction boom has sent the price of building-related commodities soaring, with timber and iron ore hitting record prices last week. Iron ore surged to $228 per tonne, which is $173 more than what the Treasury assumed when it calculated the 2021 budget. The federal government's home builder scheme is said to be putting extreme pressures on building supplies. A parliamentary committee on mental health and suicide prevention recently heard that the suicide rate among veterinary workers was four times greater than in the general population. Many in the profession are dealing with compassion fatigue, staff shortages, long working hours, inadequate pay, and frequent loss of life. The Australian Veterinary Association is developing programs to educate members about the standards and conditions they should be trying to achieve, so the profession can take responsibility for itself. And finally, a national shortage of truck drivers is causing major challenges as the demand to move goods across Australia continue to rise. The shortage is leading to increased competition for drivers across the state lines and with industries outside the freight and logistics sector. The industry is hoping it can attract more young people as the current workforce continues to age. More news at 1 o'clock.
Anthea Moody, thank you very much. I've got Kimber Wong on the line from the Bureau. Hello, Kimber Wong. Strangely, I can hear myself and not Kimber. I'll be with her in a moment.
The Queensland Country Hour with Amy Phillips on ABC Radio Queensland.
While I get her back on the line, it was the coldest morning for the year for plenty of areas in southern Queensland. Temperatures dropped as low as -4 degrees, causing major frost on the likes of the Granite Belt. John Patani says the frost event has cut his harvest short and wiped out the remainder of his crops.
It was white this morning, yeah, really white. It's -4.5 down at our farm at Fletcher. Yeah, and it's pretty much singed the tops of all our chilli plants and capsicum plants.
Would you say it would have been a major frost for you for this time of year?
Yeah, it would have been, we probably haven't had a -4.5 this early in the year for a fair while. So normally we'll have a -1 or -2 or something like that sort of around this time of the year and you'll get a little bit of damage, but yeah, this one pretty much cleaned them up. Pretty much wiped out what we had left. Yeah, look, we're picking chilies still this morning, but it'll just be all processed process stuff. So I really only had a day or two left, really, anyway. We've been going 2 weeks straight without a break. So we've been going sort of 12 hours a day just to try and get them all off, because we know it's coming. We know middle of May it's going to happen. So we just go flat out and try and get it all off.
So, I mean, how much do you think you've lost to the frost? You said you were going flat out to try and beat a major frost event. Have you?
Yeah, in chilly wise, we've probably lost 7 or 8 ton.
Yep.
At premium quality, now we'll do the 7 or 8 ton to process. So it's not a total loss, but we'll still get something for it. Bugger all, really. Like we do about 500 ton of chili. So
yeah, right. Okay, yeah. Just knocked the cream off the top, really.
Basically, yeah. This might have just upset the holiday. Maybe you can't go to the Maldives.
What about any other neighbours or growers? Have you heard of anyone
else?
Yeah, well,
I was talking to a tomato grower just next door, and actually he's got hail netting, and it usually protects a couple of degrees under the net, and even he had a -4 under there and some damage on tomatoes as well. So, yeah, it was pretty widespread.
Jack Frost visiting the Granite Belt, certainly John Patani's place, his capsicums now no more will be coming off his place due to this time of year, the cold weather marking itself, marking time and certainly making itself felt this May. I've got Kimber Wong on the line. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How's it going?
Yeah, good. So Jack Frost certainly visiting large parts of southern Queensland overnight. Will he be back tomorrow morning?
Yeah, look, there certainly is a chance that we'll see some frost areas once again tomorrow morning. We've got a very stable air mass in place at the moment, a ridge of high pressure dominating our weather, giving us those clear skies and a dry air mass over much of Queensland as well. And that is not really changing too much for tomorrow, at least. We do have a very slight turning in the winds, bringing some moisture in just along the coastal fringe overnight tonight. So our more populated centres along the coastal fringe themselves may avoid the worst of those colder temperatures that we had this morning. But further inland, it will take a couple of days for that moisture to feed further inland and bring those minimum temperatures up. So still looking at a couple of frosty mornings sort of west of the dividing range for tomorrow and possibly the next morning as well, before we start to see a little bit more quality moisture in the air returning later this working week.
People at Thargomindah will know they're alive this lunch hour. It's only 16 degrees with the apparent only 10 degrees right now. You can say
freezing.
Exactly the same for St George. But I see it's the coastal water winds that are really going to dominate our coverage of weather for the rest of the week.
Yeah, that's right. So with that ridge of high pressure that's giving us those cold mornings and clear skies during the day, we are looking at the southeasterly trade winds building in along the coast, the east coast in particular, and we have got a number of strong wind warnings current for today already. So the Cairns Peninsula and Cooktown coastal waters have a strong wind warning for today. And those strong winds are likely to sort of expand along the northern tropical coast of Queensland as we head through the next couple of days, and it really doesn't look like they're going anywhere anytime soon. That ridge of high pressure really just remaining in place and giving us those strong, fresh to strong southeasterly trade winds right along the Queensland east coast and even into the Torres Strait and beyond. So really quite windy conditions, quite choppy conditions out there. So just certainly something to be aware of if you are planning to head out on the water this week.
Are those winds going to make their way inland?
Yeah, look, we tend to see those winds, particularly in the southeast trade flow, affecting the more exposed parts of the coast and the islands just offshore as well along the east coast of Queensland. Over land, we do tend to get those windier conditions come down during the sort of early to mid-morning period once the sun comes up and we get that nocturnal jet mixing down during the first half of the day. So it can be quite breezy during the morning periods, particularly across the northwest parts of the state around Mount Isa and into the Gulf Country as well. And that certainly doesn't help when it's very cold in the morning and you get that wind chill factor as well, making those apparent temperatures really quite a lot colder than the thermometer might suggest.
Typical, isn't it? You couldn't beg for a nice cool breeze in summer. They turn up in May. Thanks so much for your time, Kimber Wong.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It is 20 to 1.
The Queensland Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
I'll have the results of the Toowoomba cattle sale for you in a moment, but the grass was crunchy at Midge Thompson's property near Kingaroy this morning. But he says he's really not sure, as an agent, if it will temper cattle prices.
Very cool, and in most places, in the low-lying areas,
a real good frost on the creek flats.
Beautiful. This time of year, most of the pastures are still green though, aren't they?
Well, they have been, of course, Amy, and but it is that time of the year, and for it to get our seasons back to some normal settings and stage, it needs to happen.
What do you think this might do to cattle prices? Will the insatiable demand, it seems, for young cattle be tightened up a little bit because of this, the beginning of winter?
I don't think it'll alter it a real lot, Amy. Demand is still as strong as ever. The only thing, a lot of our local guys, some of their country will frost, but of course any of the higher ridge country won't, which gives them a good buffer away from the frost and the cattle get in out of the cold. No, I don't think it'll alter things too much. The numbers side of things is probably more the thing that I think's going to toughen up with weeks and probably more so months to come, the availability of cattle.
How would you describe the likes of the Tugulawa Wiener sale, which was held last week?
The only thing that can describe that sale is an absolute spectacle. I did go myself, a tremendous yarding and lineup of cattle, all beautifully presented, and of course comes back to that our producers are looking heavily and strongly, and the improvement in their genetic pool at home is easy to see in the lineup of cattle.
Who buys from the likes of the Tugulawa sale, which is in a ticky area? It's unique.
Oh, look, those guys have a massive following and backing with the guys down south. There was plenty of people there from the west, like Taroom and Wandoan, and so to speak, but the New South Wales guys and Victorians are there regularly.
Wow.
So the ticks don't frighten them. A lot of our vendors up in these ticky areas go and do the job with their pre-treatments, get the job done. So for ease of scratch, the cattle to go to those clean areas.
You've just pulled up at the Gympie sale yards. You're expecting the same there?
Oh, I'd say so. I haven't been inside the yard yet, where they have actually started the heavy feed, as I can see. I'd say the trend would be strong here again today. They had a yarding of almost 2,000. So once I hop off here, I'll go in and have a look at the wiener steers and wiener heifers.
Midge Thompson, go and enjoy being among the cattle once again. This cool burst will be interesting to see how it plays out in the sale yards. Thanks for your time.
Cheers, bye for now.
I can report that for young steers, restocker steers, 200 and 280 kilos have returned on average 558 cents at the Toowoomba cattle sale. Trevor Hess will have more quotes for you soon. That was Midge Thompson, though. He's just wandered in to the Gympie sale yards to check out what prices are doing there.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Meanwhile, 10 of the country's biggest pastoral companies have thrown their support behind the rejuvenation of rural training right in the middle of outback Queensland. They all met at a recent meeting in Longreach. Madeline McCosker filed this report.
Letters from 10 pastoral companies, including Kidman Cattle Co and CPC, were included in a meeting between Agforce, Rapid and relevant state departments, while NAPCO and AACo had representatives at the meeting. The push to bring back fit-for-purpose agricultural training has shifted to a new gear recently, with Agforce determined to see training return after the closure of the state's final two facilities in Longreach and Emerald in 2019. Mike Pratt from Agforce's Sheep and Wool Board says it's essential that agriculture has training opportunities for young people.
Everybody was pretty upbeat because we all totally understand that there's a big need there. You know, industry is screaming out for workers. The wool industry has got a huge growth potential with a lot of the fences that have gone up, that exclude some fences. So yeah, there's going to be more and more demand come from the sheep and the goat industries. There's already a big demand from cattle. All of those commodities are very upbeat. They're all right in the crest of the wave. So, you know, it's just a matter of getting all the parties together and working for a common goal. And that's what we've pretty much achieved that today. We're all on the same page, which has been terribly positive. So now we've got to take that positivity and put a package together for government that they will feel as though they can understand the need, understand the want from industry, and therefore they will work together with industry and everybody else that's involved in delivering a package to make sure, you know, the outcome happens.
And you had some of the country's biggest pastoral companies in the room with you today, physically and via video link, I understand. So what were you hearing from them about, I guess, how desperate they are for training facilities to return?
They are doing a lot of the training in-house, and it's costing them a lot of money. They're running buses around, they're flying planes around, you know, with trainers to delivering these things that, you know, a proper fit-for-purpose course at a college or at a facility like the Longest Pastoral College could deliver. So it's costing them a lot of money, a lot of time, and the trouble is with that too is that it's a quick, maybe a few day course that they're delivering, and so that the opportunity is not there for those particular employees to hone their skills over a little bit of period of time. So you know, it's more or less, you know, what they're doing is I suppose in some way meeting the obligations of the companies and workplace health and safety, you know, commitments, but it's not really what they want. It's what they have to do to prepare and to protect their new employees from harming themselves and others. But it's they're desperately wanting something like what we're hoping to deliver as the best alternative for them. But at this early stage, the take-home message is that everybody totally understands that there's a huge need for this to happen. Like, who knows what the future holds, but we haven't got time on our side. We need to get this thing sorted out as quick as possible.
Mike Pratt from Agforce. Also present at the meeting was the Remote Area Planning and Development Board, which currently holds the licence to occupy the former Longreach Pastoral College, now rebranded as the Outback Hub's Training and Innovation Facility. Rapid CEO David Arnold says while the solution to the problem won't be found right away, things are moving in the right direction.
I'm positive it'll be an incremental process. This isn't a case of just banging on doors and rattling the cage. There's a few tasks for people who will take away from here. I'd like to come back in, you know, a couple of months and say, yeah, there's been real progress here.
Given that Rapid has the current licence to occupy this facility, what was the Longreach Pastoral College, where do you stand at the end of this after these discussions? Where will things be moving from here?
Look, our role is really just as, again, having the licence to occupy. We're open. We just would like to see the facility in some sort of working model. Now, we're proving that with several tenants. We're not fixed in any way, but we would like to see at the core of it, we've always wanted to see a training precinct, and we think that's a vital part of the cog. And I think when we talk to government, we've got to help government de-risk it. That's really important. Government wants the answers. I know they do. So we've got to de-risk it for government. So that's what, you know, we're open-minded. We just want a future for this location. So, yeah, this isn't a nostalgic trip, but we are in the heart of, you know, the cattle and sheep area. So I think it's got a lot to offer. We've heard that. They're not my words. I've heard industry saying that today. This place has a definite future in my mind. Otherwise, I wouldn't be hanging around continuing these discussions.
Rapid CEO David Arnold. For Matabara grazier Boyd Webb, the agricultural industry is in the middle of a staffing crisis, and agricultural training is fundamental in ensuring a future for the younger generation in the industry.
There's no training, there's no thought to the future as to where the future leaders of industry and the future leaders of agriculture are coming from, because unless you're lucky enough to grow up involved in agriculture, there's no pathway for people from the city to move into agriculture.
How vital is it that we have facilities that are training people that are ready to work, essentially, when they come to work on your property?
Well, it's a little bit like, you know, say surgeons or doctors, or it's agriculture's a specialist skill. You know, it's a specialist skill set. Like, we mightn't be jack of all trades, master of none, but it's still a large, we have to be across a lot of skills, and it's very hard to learn all of those things in one spot.
When the state government did close these facilities here in Longreach and in Emerald, the line they said was that it was just not viable for these facilities to remain open. How confident are you that the state government is going to believe in that and see it as a viable option?
I don't know what their appetite is for it. Understandably, they probably had a bit of sour milk there out of it. But it's necessary. Agriculture is a big player. It's where you don't see the benefits of agriculture maybe in the bright lights, but agriculture's there for breakfast, lunch and dinner. It's there for what you wear. Like, it is a huge part of your life, and I think we've probably got just a little bit complacent on the importance of it. We need agriculture going forward, needs the smartest minds really working in ag, and there are some very smart minds in there. Agriculture's got really a very exciting place to be, and the future is, if agriculture doesn't have a future, we don't have a future. Like, civilization doesn't have a future, so it's pretty important.
Boyd Webb, he is a Muttaburra grazier, finishing that report by Madeline McCosker. It is 10 to 1 after 1 o'clock, The World Today.
Hello, I'm Sally Sarah. Join me for The World Today. Keep the borders shut or get used to life with COVID-19. That's the dilemma facing politicians as debate rages among health experts about how to deal with the next phase of the pandemic. And with the death toll rising, Israel carries out more strikes on Gaza and Hamas continues to launch rockets. There's little sign of compromise despite international calls for peace. Those stories and more from across the country and around the globe coming up on The World Today.
On ABC Radio Queensland, you're with Amy Phillips for the Queensland Country Hour.
Now, I know that when you are a bit stiff and sore, a good massage certainly helps, but what about for your horse? Well, apparently there's a career for that, and even different methods, like some designed to improve performance. On a rainy morning in Yamundi at the Sunshine Coast, equine body worker Emma Young told Mel Groves about her field of practice learnt overseas.
I am an equine body worker. I practice the Masterson's method. It's a form of integrated equine performance bodywork. It's about working with the horse to help it release tension within the key junctions of the body.
So how exactly did you get into this equine bodywork?
Well, I've always worked with horses. I've always loved horses. And a friend of mine, when I was back in the UK, she was talking to me about it one day, and they were doing a weekend seminar, which is how you first start off with a Masterson's journey. And I went along, and that was it. I was hooked. I mean, it's such a beautiful method, and to see these horses just releasing their tension and just being more comfortable in their body, that was it. And here I am.
And you've emigrated from the UK to Australia. Is this particular type of horse massage common here in Queensland?
Well, it is. There's a few people that have gone on to these weekend courses. There's not very many certified practitioners here in Australia. So it'll be good to be able to get the voice of Jim Masterson, whose method it is. He's from America. It'll be good to be able to get the voice of Jim Masterson out, and because this method is just the most beautiful thing for the horses.
What makes this method from other more traditional types of horse massage?
Well, with this method, because it's integrated, it's something where you're working along with the horse. So you're trained to see the subtle responses within the horse to help it release its tension itself. So it's like a mixture of modalities, really. So you're kind of working with the range of motion, but you're generally watching for the responses and where the horse is basically telling you to go.
And so this is now your job, this is your career. You're here at Yamundi at the Sunshine Coast. Where do you find work doing this particular type of horse massage?
Oh, I find that it actually finds you. So it's just about putting yourself out there. I tend to give away free sessions for first sessions because, to me, it's not about making the money. It's actually about helping the horse. So I work alongside lots of other body workers because, there's red light therapy. There's all these different therapies that if you don't offer it yourself, you need to be able to recommend someone else. I think these days we're going more in the way of working as a team, working alongside the vets, the farriers. Being able to work together is going to help the horse as a whole. So it's word of mouth. As soon as you do and people see the results and they see this from their horses, and it eventually improves performance because you're improving the range of motion within the body. Not just that, but it helps rehabilitation. And when people see this, that is when they tell their friends see you, and it's just one of those things. No need to advertise.
Now, is this something that is... Is there more interest in certain sectors of the horse world? Because I know here in Australia we've got racing, we've got high-end dressage and show jumping, or pony club, or workhorses. What kind of sector do you get the most work from?
Pretty much all of the above, from what you've just said. It depends where you go. I mean, pony club, they want that faster little zippy pony. You release tension, you get the range of motion going, then they're fast. I mean, you've got the performance, the racing. There's racing up here on the coast like that. You're releasing the junctions in the shoulder and under the scapula, and they just thrive. So it's really every single modality, every single one, really.
And what about yourself? Do you have horses at home?
No, I don't. I would love to. I've got two kids. They take up their spare time at the moment. For now, it's about helping others. And then one day, I believe the horses find you. So, yeah.
But surely with two kids, is there any techniques for these massage that you can implement on the kids? Anything to maybe make them a bit quieter? Well,
the sleep easy massage.
Yes.
Yeah. No. They love it. They really love it too. They know mummy does her work, and they're into their horses. So it's great.
Yeah. Do you do much travelling for it? Do you get to travel around Queensland?
Oh, not at the moment. So, I mean, I'm all open to that. But because we've got the children, there's enough work here up on the coast and locally, like north of Gympie. Everything's going off with the Western world there. So I'm really looking forward to it. We've only just been back 6 months from our trip to the UK because we got stuck there with COVID. So we just went back for a little trip home to see the family, and we got stuck there. It's just being back and settling back in.
Emma Young, who calls herself an equine body worker or a horse masseuse, who lives on the sunny coast. And restockers have been giving other buyers like feeder operators a run for their money at the Toowoomba cattle sale. Trevor Hess has been there.
Good afternoon. There was a small reduction in supply to 226 head at the Toowoomba cattle sale today. The usual export processors were in attendance and operating. The regular feed and trade buyers were also present, plus a very large lineup of local restockers. Prices continued to improve across a number of classes, with restockers the major buyers, and on a number of occasions outbid the feeder operators on feeder weight classes. Cows also experienced a dearer trend to average up to 11 cents better. Lightweight yearling steers returning to paddock made to 608.2 to average 559. Yearling steers to feed under 330 kilos made to 510 to average 487. A few returning to paddock making to 538. Yearling steers under 400 kilos to feed averaged 472 and made to 512. A handful returning to paddock averaged 503. Heavyweight yearling steers to feed made to 430 to average 424. Lightweight yearling heifers returning to paddock or background made to 494 to average 472. Good heavyweight cows to export processors made to a top of 310.2 to average 303. This has been Trevor Hess from MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Trevor. And I see that there's 1,200 cattle booked and going under the hammer as we speak at the Gympie cattle sale this lunch hour. Making other news, though, before I wrap things up and send you to the 1 o'clock news, no surprises if you saw the amount of business transactions at Beef Week, but agribusiness Elders has again delivered a strong set of results to the market. No wonder their tent was huge at that event. Net profit is up by 31% to $68 million in the 6 months to March. The end of March, Chief Executive Mark Allison says there was growth across all states and product lines. He might have to bow out. You could never probably say that again. He also said improved market conditions and acquisitions helped drive the growth, and the business will be looking to acquire more high return on capital rural service businesses in locations where they're currently not present for the portfolio. So an announcement by Elders that they're looking to expand off the back of a huge... Net profit up 31% to $68 million. Meanwhile, the Aussie dollar is at 77 US cents, and NAB say that's on the rise following a period of very low volatility. With commodity prices like iron ore strong and risk sentiment increasing, the Australian dollar has found increasing support. NAB's forecasts point to the currency reaching 80 US cents by mid-year and 83 cents by the end of 2021. It is news time, though. 1 o'clock. I'll catch you tomorrow.